introductory to the sermon, I'll say that when I got back from Norway on Sunday evening, Monday, I was inspired from about an event from last week. That event, after Thomas had left and gone to the school, I had recorded the Super Bowl, so I took about 3 hours to watch the Super Bowl recording. And watching that recording had something to do with me giving this particular sermon today. Tone of the sermon is a little bit, it's not pornographic, I would say, but it is gaming. And I'm going to use some of the words that the Bible is using, although we wouldn't probably use these words most of the time. But it is biblical language, and I'm not going to back away from speaking in the same words in which the Bible speaks. Subject of the sermon today is going to be The Woman and the Beast. I entitled it The Woman Who Rides the Beast. Now that probably brings quite a few memories to your mind, many of you anyway. Some of the others, it might be somewhat of a new subject to you. But nevertheless, it's a very biblical sermon and one that is very biblical subject, I should say, and one that is well known to people who understand a lot about the Bible. I'd like to give recognition and thanks again to Dr. Ward, who helped me to understand what expository sermons are. This will be an expository sermon as opposed to a topical sermon. Expository sermons expose, shine light on, and take time understanding a section of the Bible. And we will be exposing, shining light on, trying to understand a section of the Bible, at least in part, which is Revelation chapter 17. So it's expository, not topical. It is a prophetic sermon because Revelation 17 is a highly prophetic chapter in the Bible. And so it's its basis, the woman riding the beast, the basis for this woman riding the beast is the book of Revelation. So my SBS is to speak to you in an expository sermon about the woman who rides the beast in Revelation chapter 17. And I start by saying there is a woman. Now, that should probably go without saying, but nevertheless, I think it is profound for us to say that and to think about it as an understanding. Here's the opening statement of the chapter in Revelation chapter 17. And this opening statement has quite a bit of information in it about what's going to follow in the whole chapter. Here John is, and this is, John is in his 90s by this time. We assume that this has got to be about 90 A.D. Christ was crucified around 31 A.D. And here it is, some maybe 60 years later, and John is on this day in prophecy, and we'll see here a day it's used in this particular segment of the Bible as well. So we'll be getting to that, and John introduces the book of Revelation by saying he was in spirit on the Lord's day. And that's probably a duplicate or something that has dual meaning. in that he was probably speaking that this revelation appeared to him on the Sabbath day, which is the Lord's day, in spite of the fact that many people who read and look at the book of Revelation try to take this as justification for Sunday worship, because they have made their own code work up to say that the Lord's day is Sunday, not Saturday. But the Lord's day is not Sunday, because it tells us in the Gospels that Christ is Lord of the Sabbath day. Well, that pretty well puts that to rest. But anyway, John is there, and we get through all of these things that he has seen in vision and records later, to here we are in the 17th chapter of the book of Revelation. At that point, the chapter opens. There came one of the seven angels, and we won't go into who the other six angels are, but this one had a particular responsibility. This angel was one of the ones which had the seven vials. So you understand right away, even though we won't go into it, that this angel's responsibility was very important to God, and something that a whole chapter of this book is devoted to. "Talk to me," John said, "saying unto me, here's who I am," this angel is saying, "here's who I am, this is what I am called to do, this is why I have come to you, and this is what you should know about what is about to ensue in this chapter. Come here, come hither. I will show unto you the judgment of the great whore that sits upon many waters." Well, there the Bible is saying that there is a woman who is not a nice woman. Rather, she is a whore, and she sits upon many waters. God is not happy with her, and before we get to the end of this age, she will be judged. A profound piece of information. The purpose in the chapter then, as explained by this angel, is it is all about the judgment of this woman. Now, involved in the chapter as well, because you can't really have the things that this woman is being judged for being explained without this other character in the cast of characters. If we say the cast of characters, here we think of the two primary ones as being the whore and the other one the beast. So the beast is intricately involved in the chapter. Is the chapter about the beast? Question. Is the chapter about the beast? No. The chapter is not about the beast. The beast is ancillary to the explanation about the chapter. But the chapter is actually about the whore and judging the whore. That's according to the angel who is delivering the message. However, references to the beast are necessary. But as I go through this sermon, I'm going to focus on the woman, and I'm going to minimize my references to the beast, which is also a very complicated presentation. The beast is a very complicated presentation. But I'll have to refer somewhat to the beast, but mostly I'm going to be talking about this woman, this whore who sits upon normal position, and as time goes by, sits upon many waters. The prophetic symbolism involved here, consistently throughout the Bible, a woman relates to a church. So when we see this whore sitting upon many waters, we understand that it is really not about a physical woman, but it is about a church. And so we just understand, because of prophetic symbolism, that that's the case. I can give you a couple of quick examples. One, Eve is used as a symbol in the Garden of Eden, well understood by all of the commentators, as a symbol of God's true church. Particularly there, it says the serpent would bite her heel, and she would bruise his head. Now that's not talking about the physical Eve. That's using Eve as womankind, as identifying right away for us that a woman is a symbol of the church. So Eve is used in that way. But here's another example where we see in the book of Revelation a woman being used as a symbol, not of a fallen church, not a bad church, but God's true church. Let's look at Revelation chapter 12, verses 4, 5, and 6. His tail. Who is his? Well, it's Satan. Satan is presented as a dragon with a big tail, and his tail drew the third part of the stars of heaven. That is, the angel, one-third of the angels are here identified by stars of heaven, followed Satan. And did cast them to the earth. So it's about the rebellion of Satan and ultimately his being assigned to the earth with the demons. The dragon, then, this Satan, stood before the woman. Who is the woman? Well, you can look up, I guess, in chapter 1. It says she has a crown with stars around her head. It's presented in a very positive way. This woman is God's true church. The dragon stood before the woman, which was to be delivered, for to deliver her child as soon as it was born. This woman was going to bring forth a child. Who is that child? That child is Jesus Christ, who was sent to this earth by God the Father to be the Savior of all of mankind. She brought forth this woman, this symbol of God's true church. God's true church brought forth a man-child who was to rule all nations. That leaves out any doubt about who this child was, Jesus Christ, with a rod of iron, and her child was caught up to God and his throne. Well, Satan was not able to destroy the child, and when Christ was crucified, he then was caught up to God the Father and his throne. The woman fled into the wilderness, where she had a place prepared of God that they should feed her there 1,260 days, 80 days. Some of the translations say times and a half time, or 3.5 years. So there's a big contrast here. Both cases, the whore sitting on the waters is a spiritual symbol of a woman. A woman is a spiritual symbol of the church. The contrast is, here, this woman is a spiritual symbol of God's true church. So I hope you understand and see that I'm demonstrating to you here that in prophecy, a woman is a symbol of the church. This woman, this whore, was doing what whores do. What do whores do? They will sell you any part of their body or anything that you want to do for money. This spiritual whore was willing to sell herself for power and influence. Starting with year 130 is the first record that I know of about it, when on the island of, I can't think of the name, but anyway, in the Mediterranean Sea, there was a Quarto Decimum controversy, in which the Roman Church argued for the keeping of Easter against the bishops of the two churches in Asia, Ephesus and Smyrna, Polycarp and Polycrates, who argued for the keeping of the Passover. Followed as time went by, the time of Constantine came, and the Sabbath day was sold for power and influence in the Roman government, this whore selling herself. Christmas and Easter followed as this whore sold herself so that she could have congregants and people throughout the rest of Europe who would join her in her church. Power and influence by numbers was the thing. Food laws were sold down the drain. God, taking God's name in vain was also no longer a problem. Blatant idolatry everywhere. And so all of the things that were most precious, you know, to, if you would think of it in terms of a physical woman, the things that were most precious to her were sold, as a whore would do in a physical case. Fact is, there is a woman, and this woman will do anything for power and influence. So if we know that there is a woman, let's identify that woman. We go to the very last verse in Revelation chapter 17. It's a fairly short chapter. 17 verses in the chapter. Here it says something that might be a little bit of a head scratcher, since I said that a woman in prophecy is a church. Because here in Revelation chapter 17 and verse 18, it says, "The woman which you saw is that great city." Is a city a woman? "Is that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth." So the question is here, is this woman a city? Or is she not a church? Let's jump back up to Revelation chapter 17 and verse 9. We get some information here about this city, in that it says in Revelation chapter 17 and verse 9, "How much wisdom do we have?" That's the question that might be posed by this verse of Scripture. Here is the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads, these relate to the beast and so on, the seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. Seven mountains on which the woman sits. Well, Rome is famous as a city which was built on seven hills. Mountains, hills. and we don't want to go too much into that. But there are stories of Romulus and Remus, who were Babylonian, I guess, coming to Rome. They had been raised by wolves, so there's probably some demonism involved in this story. But they had supposedly been raised by wolves. They came to Rome and founded the city of Rome on seven hills. And we're thinking also a little bit about the fact that this Rome is referred to as Babylon, and the origins of the city, at least if Romulus and Remus, anything about the stories of Romulus and Remus be true, then there's a Babylonian foundation behind it. Rome is a city built on seven hills. So the question is, could we be reading about the city of Rome? Well, the answer is, the question was, is this maybe just about the city of Rome and not about a church? That's the question. The answer is, biblically, a city is often used as a symbol of a church in the Bible. And that's the case here. This city is a symbol of the church which sits in that city. Here's an example of where you would see that demonstrated in the Bible. And we can find probably any number, or quite a few examples in the Bible of when a city is used to sort of co-identify a church that is based in that city. But here's one I thought is particularly relevant for you and I. Galatians chapter 4 and verse 26. Jerusalem, now are we talking about a city when it says Jerusalem? Well, Jerusalem is a city, isn't it? But is Jerusalem just a city? No, Jerusalem is identifying also God's true church. You and I, we are, as we sit and worship God on His holy Sabbath day, we are a small functional part of what the Bible identifies as Jerusalem. Jerusalem, which is above, not Jerusalem in Palestine, but Jerusalem, nevertheless, and that city is being used as a symbol of God's true church, as Rome is being used as a symbol, that city Rome is being used as a symbol of the Roman church. And it is in that church where this whore sits upon seven hills. Jerusalem, which is above, is free, which is the mother of us all. Is God's church our mother? We are begotten by God the Father, but is there also a mother? Yes, God's true church is our mother. And we are, in a sense, living in embryo, awaiting the resurrection of the dead, at which time we will be born. So when the Bible talks about Jerusalem as the symbol of God's true church, and when the Bible talks about the city here, it's not just talking about the city, but it's talking about the church which is in that city, and the woman that is based in that city is the church which is being described here. Here's what William Burkett, one of the commentators that I have on my Power Bible CD, has to say about this. He says, this is so clear a description that the Church of Rome herself acknowledges it. not only does every, and I have like 12 commentators, I went through and looked at all the 12 commentators, and not one of them took exception to the fact that this church is, is talking about Rome and the Roman Catholic Church. This is so clear a description of Rome that the Church of Rome herself acknowledges it. And I guess they did, or they do. I'm not sure what the situation is there, but they did acknowledge it at one time. And if I understand correctly, I'm not an expert on this, and I haven't researched it either, but it's my understanding that for this reason, the Book of Revelation is not included in the Catholic Bible. Be that as it may. The church, it says, the Church of Rome acknowledges that this is talking about it. For if that be the city built upon seven hills, the city that allures the inhabitants of the earth to idolatry, if her idolatries be a lively image of the old pagan idolatries, if to her many kings have given their power and strength, and if she rules over the kings of the earth, there remains no doubt but that this great city is Rome, that Rome is mystical Babylon, which has shed the blood of the saints and martyrs without number, and must be destroyed for so doing. No pomp nor grandeur can exempt or save her from the revenging hand of God and His just indignation. So says Mr. Burton. And I think we probably can see a substantial amount of truth in what he has to say. Further questions? You know, we identify the center of this subject matter for Revelation chapter 17, this woman who is going to, as we will see, ride the beast. But what about other parts as well? There is not only a church at Rome, but there was also their similar church, which was at one time located in Constantine, and now, and I was surprised at how many people will bring this up in this area. Now in Moscow is the third Rome. They call it the third Rome. And so, is that included in what is being said here, which was centered and is still centered in the city of Rome in Italy? And if we go a little bit further than that, what about the Protestant daughters who were born from the whore? Are they part of that whore as God looks at it? I can't answer the question. I can pose the question, but I can't answer. There is a unanimous consensus among the commentators that this relates, as the 12 commentators that I have on my Power Bible, that this relates to the Roman Church. So, for that identity, who we got to identify? There is a woman. How do we identify that woman? That woman is identified, the whore of Revelation is at least in part, can hardly be any question about it, the church at Rome. And I would, it'd be my opinion, is more likely all of false Christianity. What is the present condition of the woman? The woman's seemingly rather sedate. There have been times in history when the woman has been very aggressive. You know, you can think about the Spanish Inquisition and that time period, and I think probably the 12 and 1300s, 1500s even, when the Roman Catholic Church put many people to death. And the time of the Crusade was alluded to by our president yesterday in the prayer breakfast, in trying to justify, or by comparison, you know, comparative justification for what ISIS is doing to various people in the Middle East now. Well, look at what what people did in the name of Christianity. Well, I don't think there's any justification, but a lot of what we consider Christianity is false Christianity, isn't it? But that, those times have gone by. We don't see those times presently. Now, the woman seems to be sitting placidly on the water. Revelation 17:1, there came one of the seven angels which had the seven vials, talked with me, saying, come hither, I will show you the judgment of the great whore that sits upon many waters. As we look around now, we don't see the kind of aggressive nature that the Roman Catholic Church has shown in centuries gone by. Now, it is sitting on water. So, let's take a look at the scripture in verse 15, which identifies what the water is. Because it's symbolic water. It's not something that came out of your bathtub, not something that came out of the ocean. This is spiritual water, and it consists of, as it says to me, Revelation 17, verse 15, the angel said to me, the waters which you saw where the whore sits are peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. That's what we see right now. This whore, not presenting herself as a whore at this period of time, but having this history, and if we understand it properly, having still the same nature, is riding on the top of many peoples, nations, and so forth. You can look at South America, predominantly Roman Catholic. You can look at what vestige of religion remains in Western Europe, and it's primarily Roman Catholic. There's a heavy contingent of Roman Catholicism in the United States. There is, in many places of the world, Roman Catholicism. And in other places, there is a quite heavy contingent of Orthodox Catholics, if we want to say the second and third Roman. And if we go through many areas of the world, we will find also that there is a lot of Protestantism in some of those places. But that's how the waters are identified. The present condition of the woman is sitting quietly on the waters at this point. There's not a lot of turmoil in the waters. There's not a lot being stirred up, although there are lots of things going on which may result in that. An example that we have seen in our lifetimes, in this century, of how this woman can influence the attitudes of a whole people and a whole nation, and somehow gain sway over those people, happened, I don't know now, it's probably 25 years ago, in Poland, and John Paul, the Pope, the Roman Pontiff at the time, visited Poland, and he stirred up the people of Poland to such an extent that ultimately the Soviet Union started to unravel from that point, based on the influence that John Paul held over the Polish people at that time. There is a very interesting documentary on Newsmax TV. Newsmax TV is available in most areas now. It's not really, you might think, a real channel in the way that a lot of other channels are, but it presents a lot of very interesting information. One of the things that it presented was a documentary on that trip of John Paul to Poland. And I don't know if you have access to that channel. I think most of you would. And I don't know if they're still showing that, because it's been some time back since I watched it, but probably they will show it from time to time. At that time, Lech Walesa and Solidarity movement began, and the support of the Polish people was very strong, and the Soviet Union, which had held control over Poland at that time, started to dissolve right there at that point. It was a very difficult time for Poland following that, but nevertheless, John Paul, who was Polish, went there and made that. So this is an example of this woman, and how this woman, even though sitting pretty much quietly on the waters for the entire history of my life, can, from time to time, exert herself. She's sitting and waiting for her hour, because her hour is coming. That hour will be at the very end of this age. Now remember, we're talking about the judgment of God on this earth. So at the end of this age, a beast shall rise and have power for 1 hour. Power for 1 hour. Revelation chapter 17, verse 12. Now, without again trying to go into what the information about the beast, this beast has 10 horns, and it's explaining here something about those horns, although the purpose of this chapter is primarily the judgment of the whore. 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings, which have received no kingdom as yet. And this was at the time John was writing, in the 90s AD, but here we are 1900 plus years later, and this kingdom has not still been received. They have not yet received the kingdom, but they will. We are sure that they will. They will receive power as kings, it says, for 1 hour with the beast. I don't know if this has anything to do with the information that I mentioned to you in the sermonette, as far as a day for a year, 1 hour. Could that somehow relate to a period of time which this beast may have power? 1 hour, if we look at a day for a year, and we take 1/24th of that day, how much time will we be talking about? we'd only be talking about 15 and a half days. Is that reasonable? Well, we'd have to throw that one out, wouldn't it, just from the context, because we don't think this woman is going to ride the beast for 15 and a half days. If we go to a 1,000-year definition of a day, and we take 1/24th of that 1,000 years, that would mean 1 hour would be 42 2/3 years. I don't know if that's a reasonable thing to do or not. I'm not suggesting that it is, but it's a question that comes to my mind. It could it be that this is talking about this beast is going to have power for 42 2/3 years? I don't know. Maybe this one hour doesn't mean anything. Maybe it's just an offhanded reference that this angel makes. How do we come to, and maybe it just means a short time. Maybe that's all it really means. And I think I'd have to go back, and I might overdo this, I ought to go back maybe and look at some of the original language in regard to this and see if it's being translated the same way by everybody. 1 hour. 1 hour. Interesting. When that happens, this woman will no longer sit placidly on the waters. There will be a transformation. The woman will become aggressive and very, very active in conjunction with this beast that's being described here in Revelation chapter 17. She will go from sitting to riding. Matthew 24 and verse 24, what could bring this about? How could this woman become so magically transformed, and seemingly in such a short period of time? As we look at how the deterioration in her power has gone on over a long period of time, probably going back at least a couple of hundred years. Christ says this, Matthew 24 and verse 24, a pair of 24s. There will arise false Christs. Now, he's talking about the end of the age. And he's saying at the end of the age, there will arise, as though they are not there until this particular point, there will arise false Christs and false prophets, and they shall show great signs and wonders. Great signs and great wonders. It's a parallel piece of information there. These false Christs and false prophets will show great signs and wonders. And I would have to presume that it's these great signs and wonders shown by these false Christs and false prophets which are going to be the power which transforms this woman, this whore, who now sits on the waters waiting for her time, transforms her into, once again, an aggressive and meaningful power who is going to ride this beast. Going to go from sitting to riding. That's where I got kind of intrigued during the Super Bowl. Because everything was football until right up, boom, at the time of the half. And quickly, the lights went out in the stadium. Everything was dark. The field was transformed by, no doubt, many hours of concerted effort putting this together so that it could be produced and delivered to you and I on television in a very short 15-minute period of time. Interesting how this particular halftime show developed. The spectacular accomplishment electrically and artistically which brought it about. And we saw there the most wonderful situation from sitting to writing. No doubt the people who were in this presentation were sitting right up until the time when all of a sudden they were transformed into the situation, putting this show on. The lights went out, and magically, as far as our eyes were concerned, I watched a little commentary. There was maybe 5 minutes of commentary between the people talking about the football game. And so when that was over, they came right back to the field to show us the halftime show. The halftime show, it's been reported on the news a few different times, is the number one cultural event. Now, well, the Super Bowl itself is the number one cultural event in the United States now. Now, I don't know where they get that information. It seems to me that's just a matter of opinion. But they said it's even more important than Christmas. That's what I've heard them say. I don't know if that's true or not. But anyway, if it isn't true, it's close enough. Close enough for our purposes. So, magically, then, when we come back from listening to these announcers talking about this play, that play, the other player, the other play, the one player or another, and what the players need to do, and what the coaches and teams need to do, as we're fed that boredom, then we come back onto the field. And during the time when that was being held, this field has been transformed, and suddenly, onto the camera, comes this magical electronic beast. And this woman, and I don't mean to relate the woman to the language of the Bible, I have no knowledge of anything about her, except that she's a performer, and many performers can perform different parts. For example, in Man of La Mancha, Sophia Loren portrayed the part of a kitchen slut and a whore. Well, she was not either one, and I don't make any such connection to the woman who sings and rides on this beast. But magically, out of nowhere, this electronic beast appears. And it's clearly a beast. And this woman is prancing and dancing and singing and riding the beast. And the beast itself is prancing and dancing with the woman. With the most euphoric expression on the face of the beast, as well as on the facial expression of the woman. Here's an important thing to note. Whenever someone rides a horse, whenever someone rides an elephant, whenever someone rides a camel, and our kids have ridden horses, elephants, and camels, whatever animal that may be ridden, the rider is in control of what is being done by the animal. And so that is what we have to understand when it says this woman is going to ride the beast. And as far as the part that music plays in this world, I think that music is really, really important. And these kinds of events are really interesting in that I just have the belief that they are not just being physically inspired by human beings, but that they are being inspired, even though a human being has his name as the author of something or the producer of something like this, they're ultimately being inspired, even though the author or the producer don't realize what they are doing in relationship to the spiritual events, that these things are being inspired spiritually. And that Satan the devil is the great master musician. I give you song from Barry Manilow, going back into the 1980s. I write the song. And Barry Manilow sings that song. And he makes a case, and he doesn't understand the song in the same way, I'm convinced. But those songs are written by someone who has the power to write through a long period of time and write through a lot of different people. I write the songs, I write the songs. I've talked about Puff the Magic Dragon. You know, it makes the dragon into a most wonderful character. But a lot of the symbolism that is used in the book of Revelation about that dragon can be seen in the song if you analyze the words and you're not just singing something nice and lyrical. I remember at one time going to a musical in New York City called Aida. And that musical being portrayed in New York, being presented in New York City, we were there because Lindsay Todd was there to have Johnson O'Connor tested, which we have done for many of the young people through the years. And she was there on that, and she asked to see this musical because it was the newest, most exciting new musical on Broadway at that time, Aida. Well, Aida was a musical about Egypt. And Egypt, of course, is a symbol of this present evil world. And the music in there, I was so negatively affected by that music. I can't even tell you the sort of the central song to that, and it was written by Elton John. The central song to that was "Like Father, Like Son." Like father, like son, and the father was evil, and so was the son. So what's the message there? And who wrote that song? Did Elton John really write that song, or was somebody else trying to say something about God the Father and Jesus Christ? Frequently there are hidden messages in music. I just get the impression that we, when I say we, mankind is being laughed at by a segment. A segment, not all, but a segment of the spirit being, who like to make sport out of us. And here's this woman just presenting so dramatically the image of what is talked about here in Revelation chapter 17. Verse 13, these have one mind and shall give, they're talking about some different nations, will give power and strength to the beast. And these shall make war with the Lamb, the Lamb shall overcome them, for he is King of kings and Lord of lords. This woman, and I don't have the scripture around here. This woman, it says in Revelation chapter 17, is going to ride the beast. This whore is going to be in control and position to control what this beast is doing, at least for a certain period of time. She's the whore that sits on many waters. She will be in control of an evil power that is going to come up. Ultimately, what is the judgment for this woman? This woman is going to receive judgment of God. This woman is going to cease to exist. If we were talking about a physical human being, she would be killed. Revelation chapter 17 and verse 16. We're getting close to the end of the book of chapter 17 here, because it's only 18 verses. The 10 horns which you saw upon the beast, these shall hate the whore. Well, wait a minute. This whore who kind of transforms and brings about this beast power and has been a part with the beast over the millennia in which it has existed, that they're going to hate the whore and make her desolate and naked and eat her flesh and burn her with fire. I saw on today's news that woman lion trainer was attacked by a lion in the cage. It's also reminiscent, isn't it, of Siegfried and Roy in the year 2003. That's about 12 years ago now. Roy Horn of Siegfried and Roy was putting on a show with tigers in Las Vegas, Nevada. And as he was doing that, a white Siberian tiger decided to turn on Roy Horn. And he came at Roy Horn, and he had his head completely in his mouth, and they thought that he was going to bite Roy Horn's head off. Somehow, they were able to extricate Roy Horn from the tiger. He's still alive, and I saw a picture taken a few years ago now, because the tiger died 2 years ago. Some years after that, Roy Horn feeding that white Siberian tiger. But that's kind of what's being said here. This woman is kind of like the ruler, the power behind the beast, and here suddenly this beast is going to turn on this woman, and as that tiger did to Roy Horn, tear her to pieces. These shall hate the Lord, and shall make her desolate and naked, shall eat her flesh, kind of almost cannibalism. It's obviously not a physical woman and not a physical cannibalism, but nevertheless, it's enough to give you some imagery about what is being talked about here. And burn her with fire. Here's the reason this is going to happen. Verse 17. God has put it in their hearts. Who? Who are they? They are the nations of this beast. Put it in their hearts to fulfill His will. It is His will that this whore, this church which is centered in Rome, should ultimately be completely destroyed. God has put it in their hearts to fulfill His will. It is God's will. This is not something I could or would give to you in a message like this, except it says here, this is God's will. And to agree and to give their kingdom unto the beast until the words of God shall be fulfilled. Well, God put it in their hearts to destroy this woman. The conclusion of the chapter is about the judgment of this woman. Question? How comprehensive is this judgment? And I don't know, and I don't think anybody knows, who is going to fall under this judgment? The Pope? Cardinals? What about bishops? What about local priests? What about deacons? If you go down the hierarchy, who is included in this judgment? I don't know. I don't think anybody knows. This is God's judgment on the whole. What about congregants? We probably all doubt that they would be included. What about children who've attended? Almost certainly not. Nevertheless, it says she's going to be cannibalized. This whore is going to be cannibalized. Her flesh, those people who are a part of this church, especially the higher hierarchy of the church, it would seem to be saying, are going to be cannibalized. Allegorically, not literally. What about fire? Burned? Well, maybe this beast power who's going to turn on the whore, it says, and burn her. Maybe all of the places of worship will end up being burned. I don't know. Nevertheless, it's clear to us that the beast, this 10-nation power group, will execute God's judgment. Here's the conclusion. There has been this whore for 2,000 years. Her normal position is sitting on the waters. At the end of this age, she will participate in the rising of the beast. She will ride on that beast, exercising the control of a rider. The woman will control the beast. But there is a judgment. God's judgment against this whore. She will be killed and destroyed by the beast. Let's say the spirits are laughing as human beings sort of adulate this woman on a beast, then ultimately other spirit beings also might be laughing. And the old proverb says, he who laughs best. I don't believe it's going to be laughing for anybody, though. I don't believe that anyone at that time will be laughing. I don't believe that God will be laughing. But this is the expository sermon about the woman and the judgment of the woman from Revelation chapter 17.